which is number 06-2259, Curtis Johnson against Nedra Chandler. Mr. Frankel.
Thank you. Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Scott Frankel, and I represent the petitioner, Curtis Johnson. At the district court level, in this case, we spent a lot of time arguing about whether it was ineffective assistance of counsel when trial counsel failed to interview or call who we characterized as a critical witness in the case. On appeal, I think the main issue is a little bit different because in the Attorney General's brief, they raised the issue of timeliness. This timeliness issue had been resolved in favor of the petitioner by Judge Gettleman, but from the time that he resolved it to this point in time, the law has become more settled with regard to timeliness. So the issue becomes whether the two periods that Judge Gettleman excluded from the one-year statute of the limitations period for filing a 2254 petition, whether he properly excluded those two time periods.
Mr. Frankel, as you know, the AEDPA limits equitable tolling to extraordinary circumstances, and since every pro se prisoner has to contend with the tolling provisions of the AEDPA, what aspect of this case would bring it into the realm of extraordinary?
Well, first of all, we're only talking about 18 days. If you look at the record, Curtis Johnson availed himself of every possible opportunity to present his case. I think the one period of time where there was some lapse was when he had an opportunity to file a petition for leave to appeal from the denial of his state court habeas corpus. That petition for leave to appeal was filed late, but the Illinois court ended up hearing the petition for leave to appeal and denying it. But he availed himself of every possible opportunity. Many of his efforts were made pro se. In this case, at the time, the state of the law was clearly unsettled. I think that it was reasonable under the circumstances for Mr. Johnson to rely on what he believed was the state of the law at the time that he filed his petition. And indeed, Judge Gettleman agreed with him at the time and said that his petition could move forward. And then he appointed counsel at that point. With regard to the second period, I think, that we're talking about here, the 90-day period during which a petitioner, a state court habeas corpus petitioner, could file but didn't file a cert petition. This court has decided in a couple cases in Gildan versus Bowen and Jones versus Hulock that the 90-day period is not tolled, that 90-day period operates against the petitioner. This court's position in those cases is adverse or different from the position that was taken in the Sixth Circuit in the Abella case that we cited. Currently, before the Supreme Court, is a case entitled Lawrence versus Florida, and while not exactly on point, a similar issue was pending, and in that case, cert was granted by the United States Supreme Court to decide whether the limitations period under 2254 is tolled during the pendency of a petition for a writ of certiorari from a judgment denying relief. In that case, involved a capital defendant who had actually filed a cert petition. In our case, we have someone who has not filed a cert petition. I think the issues are close enough related that it's worth waiting at least to see how the Supreme Court's going to decide Lawrence versus Florida before dismissing this petitioner's petition on timeliness grounds. We did argue, Your Honor, that, and for the reasons I've already stated, that equitable estoppel principles should be applied in the alternative to allow him to proceed with this petition. If the court reaches the merits of the petition, we urge you to reverse the trial court. What we have here is a case where there were three eyewitnesses to a murder. Two of the eyewitnesses saw, picked the petitioner out of a lineup. The third eyewitness went to a lineup with the petitioner in it and said that he did not see the offender. The trial attorney failed to interview that witness, failed to call that witness as a witness at the trial. Essentially, the witness, Danny Turner, was a witness that the defendant, the petitioner, did not commit the murder. It seems impossible that that failure to call this person as a witness in the defense was not ineffective assistance of counsel and did not result in prejudice to the petitioner. For all those reasons, we urge you to reverse the district court. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Frankel.
Good morning, Your Honors, Counsel, and may it please the Court. My name is Carl Treble. I'm with the Office of the Illinois Attorney General, representing the respondent warden.
Could this I court just get something out of the way? Forgive me. Did the Illinois Appellate Court err when it determined that Mr. Johnson's ineffectiveness claim was barred by res judicata? In other words, was the issue actually decided on the merits on direct appeal in the state court?
On direct appeal, petitioner attempted to raise the issue, and they said the state appellate court held that that issue was not properly raised at that time. Petitioner raised it again in his post-conviction petition. The state appellate court decided two things. It decided, first of all, that the two affidavits that he'd presented were not new evidence that were sufficient to overcome res judicata. And then they also decided, they said, I think, quote, for the same reasons, we find that the failure to call Danny Turner as a witness did not prejudice his case. And I think the reasons they cite to were that those two affidavits were not conclusive evidence that showed that Danny Turner's testimony would have helped his case. And that's the portion of the merits of this case that should be viewed under the extraordinary deference of 2254 D1. Petitioner has not shown that the state court's decision on the prejudice prong was objectively unreasonable. As petitioner stated, there were two eyewitnesses in this case.
So you concede it was error for the court to rule that res judicata applied?
Your Honor, as a matter of state law,
since the court never got to the merits at the lower level.
It never got to the performance prong for sure, Your Honor. I do think it was an error of state law for them to hold that res judicata barred it, I think, but that was a question of state law. I do think that their prejudice holding, though, is what's applicable on review before this court. And concerning the prejudice prong, two eyewitnesses testified that they were positive that petitioner was the murderer, the person that had held them at gunpoint and then had shot and killed Dan Williams. At the trial, Detective Reardon testified, which I didn't cite in my brief, it's on page 299 of the trial record. Detective Reardon testified that Danny Turner had been called to a lineup and had failed to identify the petitioner. So the jury had already heard through Detective Reardon that there was a third eyewitness who had been unable to identify the petitioner as the murderer through that lineup procedure. But the district court held an evidentiary hearing, and we've learned through that process that Danny Turner's testimony would not have been helpful to the petitioner's case. Danny Turner, it turns out, doesn't remember the face of the murderer. He saw him, quote, but he didn't see him. And that type of testimony would not have been helpful. And in fact, petitioner got the best of both worlds at his trial. Whether it was intended or not, it appears in hindsight to have been a good strategy to not call Danny Turner. The petitioner's attorney was able to get out at trial that Danny Turner made this non-identification in the lineup without getting into evidence the fact that Danny Turner never really saw the murderer's face. So in light of those circumstances, there was no prejudice, whether it's viewed under 2254 as a matter of deference to the state courts or even under de novo review, there's simply no evidence of prejudice in this case. But going to the timeliness argument, Your Honors, I wanted to make a couple of other points. First of all, to show extraordinary circumstances, the petitioner must show that there was something outside of his control that prevented him from filing on time. The fact that this court had not clearly established an interpretation of 2244 at the time he filed his federal habeas application is not an extraordinary circumstance. Essentially, the petitioner was acting as his own attorney at the time, was faced with the 2244 new one-year statute of limitations, and had a decision to make. When should I file? He read, unfortunately for him, the most liberal interpretation of that statute possible. He should have read the most conservative interpretation possible, which would have ensured that he filed within the one-year statute of limitations. This court has previously held that the failure to get good legal counsel or the failure as a pro se petitioner to even understand the law is not an extraordinary circumstance that entitles one to equitable tolling. Also, petitioner's counsel mentioned that it appears he was only about 18 days late. But in United States versus Marcello, this court has held that even if you just missed a deadline, it doesn't entitle one to equitable tolling. And finally, petitioner mentioned the Lawrence case, which was argued in November in the U.S. Supreme Court. As petitioner mentioned, that case is not precisely on point. This court noted that in its Jones v. Hulick holding. That case involved a petitioner who had filed for a petition for writ of certiorari after the state court's discretionary denial of his state post-conviction petition. That would not be controlling in this case, and therefore it's probably technically not necessary to wait, but the respondent would not oppose waiting. I expect that decision to come out in the next few weeks with the light docket that the court's facing right now. So based on those arguments, Your Honor, it's the petition is both untimely and petitioner cannot show that the state court's decision was objectively unreasonable as to the prejudice prong. We also argued that under the performance prong, petitioner has not met his burden of proof there, but I would just submit that argument on the briefs unless the panel has any questions. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Treble. How much time does Mr. Frankel have? You have 4 minutes, sir.
In response to Mr. Treble's timeliness argument that the petitioner should have reviewed the most conservative law regarding the statute of limitations, I think under the circumstances that would be unfair to him because in his own case, Judge Gettleman reviewed the law and said that his petition was timely. So even if he had been diligent and reviewed the law as best as he could, I think he would have reached the same conclusion that his petition was timely. With regard to Danny Turner's testimony at the hearing that was held in the trial court here, Danny Turner specifically said that he viewed the lineup and he did not see the offender in that lineup. Mr. Treble argues that a detective testified that Danny Turner viewed a lineup but didn't see the person in it, and so the jury got that information. The problem is that in closing argument, the state's attorney got up and argued and said, "Where is Danny Turner? If he really didn't see the guy in that lineup, where is he? He should be here in this trial." And he was doing that in response to an argument that defense counsel had made. But defense counsel had highlighted Danny Turner's absence in his own strategy in the case. And so for those reasons, we think that there was clearly ineffective assistance of counsel and there was clearly prejudice. Unless the court has any additional questions, I'll rest on the briefs. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Frankel, you served by appointment of the court, and you have the deep thanks of the court for your fine efforts on behalf of your client. My thanks to both counsel. The case